Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry and put that pools in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money, major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
And it needs to be a little bit of Jamarian Stiles and all of us doing the impossible. Working with what we got, today's podcast is titled, our last one was titled, Chinese Food Cash Flow versus 9-to-5 Paycheck, 619-768-2945. But we got a special guest before all of that. Good morning, Robin.
Well, good morning. Hi, everyone.
So what do you have on the agenda to start off with before we get into Chinese food cash flow versus 9-to-5 paychecks?
We have a wonderful lady that I wanted to bring in and include in on the dialogue because she does a lot of service work for the homeless. She shared with me, and I'll let her tell us more about that in detail, but she shared with me about how an Indian tribe in Oklahoma built tiny homes, two tiny
okay,
homes.
Okay, well, I'm familiar with Oklahoma a little bit.
Yeah.
I got a little land up in Muskogee County.
So because of her service work, and her and her husband will get in the car, and they will even drive out of state to go get someone and take them in, and get them into treatment. They're just really wonderful. Peggy Osborne.
Okay, so Miss Osborne, or Mrs. Osborne, your mic is open.
Good morning. Miss Robin Lynn Maven, thank you so much for inviting me. I want to stay. Pleasure.
So tell everyone,
to be here.
Peggy, tell everyone, if you will, about some of the things that you and your husband do in the community, and tell us about your husband. He is he's an Indian, correct?
Yes,
Native
American. Yes.
He's from the Wyandotte tribe in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. What county are they in?
I was out there just for all week. We just got home yesterday. I want to say it's Wyandotte. No, Wyandotte.
What's the nearest? You know what?
Finnegan,
I'll look it up while you're talking. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yes, the closest town is Seneca. And what they do is they have a lot of inner tribes. There's domestics. People are drinking. There's drugs sometimes. And so what they have done, they've got grants. And they have built already. Two small homes are out there, and we went and seen them. They're on the property in our community where they have built small homes for the senior citizen people. Mm-hmm. And we just built a new splash pad for the kids. They are Wyandotte. They had a meeting this weekend because they have to vote on directors, legislation inside the tribe, elect officers. So when the tribe was telling us about the small houses, and they're there for anyone, not just their tribal people, but they are there for anyone in the area or in Oklahoma or probably other states so that they can help them. They are about family, connecting family, keeping family together. Mm-hmm. So when we were there, there was a lady, and she was in need, and we got her connected, actually, to Miss Lisa to get her services because she was in need of services, definitely, to get out of the situation she was in. And so I wasn't leaving Wyandotte, and we got her into the services, so I was happy. And we do, they just do so much for their community out there because it's so family-oriented. We've been going out there over 20 years. My husband's been on the roster with the Wyandotte Nation for over, since he was born, you know, since he's been born, he's been on the roster. We've been going out there. Just very family-oriented, doing what the community needs because there's so many needs. Children. Sorry, some of them, some of their parents are gone. And here in Columbus as well, we make street bags. We take them to out on the street. anyone that is struggling with addiction, we can get them into a clinic immediately, today, with no insurance or no ID. And we make street bags, peanut butter waters, make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, take out clothes that people's donated, coats, anything that's needed. We take to emergency women's shelters, men's shelters. I pick people up if they want to come to Ohio and get a whole new life. We'll get them there.
Hmm.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, sir. Yes.
So what was it that led you into helping so many other people?
My daughter, I've always helped people, but the last 5-6 years, my daughter has been passed away. She passed away 9 years ago from heroin overdose. And she worked 2 jobs. So I didn't know that, you know, she was really doing anything like that. So when she passed away about 3 years, I was like, you know, of course, I didn't want to, in those 3 years, grief takes you to many different places. You know, there's anger, there's, you just really don't want to get up, you don't want to do anything. And so I got tired of being like that, I got tired of not, just got tired of being tired and not doing anything. So I was like, you know what, there's too many people here that's passing away, we have so many children, so many youth, so many young people, we have to do something. We have to stand up. We have to do something. Guns, drugs are taking our children at an alarming, alarming rate. So we actually, that's when I decided to start Autumn's Way Through Helping Others. That's when I decided to make the street bags, pick people up, take them to a clinic, women's emergency shelter, men's clinics. Just because I didn't see an air community, I didn't think that there was enough being done. So I just had to do something, and I've just never stopped, and I've just seen to, we get more donations for clothes, cases of bottled water we take out, sandwiches, make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, take out, put in the street bags with Narcan, clothes, shoes, socks, what, anything that anyone has given us, we take it straight out. We sit on the corner, we pass out street bags, give them information, rides. But that's what started me. doing this was when my when I lost my daughter, Autumn, to heroin. And here in Columbus, we actually have 140,000 grandparents that are raising grandchildren because they have no parents. Their children are either locked up or they have passed away from drugs, gun violence. So it's just, we have to be out there every day doing something. You know, and I also network with 13 different clinics. We can get into anyone, men, women, mothers that are pregnant, mothers that have their children, fathers that have their children. We can also get them into a clinic. And after 30, 60, 90 days, they will get them a car, help them get a job and a new place to live away from the exact community that they were in. It seems that if people stay in the exact same place, they are connected with the same people, and they're more likely to do a little bit different scenery, kind of, you know, helps out a little bit to get out of that situation.
Okay, so you're in Columbus, Ohio now.
Yes, yes, I am. Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's the largest city, I think, it's the largest city in Ohio.
Yes, sir. And there is our city, our streets. You know, you can go by, drive by. You see women, men, young ladies, young boys out just at the abandoned houses. They sleep, they stay there. It's pretty sad, you know, with the homeless and the drugs here is, meth is bad. Fentanyl is really bad, but the meth seems to be, we have a large overdose rate that people are smoking crack, which we've never heard of that before. Our coroner's office has put out information when we have a large surge of deaths about please go out into the community, carry more Narcan, pass out more Narcan, go to the homeless camps, pass out more stuff there, just because we know that there is a big surge of overdoses. So we're always out. And we also network with harm reduction.
But what kind of reduction?
A harm reduction.
I never heard of that before.
Okay, sir. We are actually, they're trying to get more built in different cities and states. Harm Reduction is a great organization. They give all kinds of testing strips for fentanyl, Narcan. They pass out new needles. They do wound care. Their main goal is to pass out testing strips and Narcan to reverse the fentanyl and the meth. And they are a large organization. You can Google them. They will send and mail Narcan to you. I think each city and state, you have to watch a little video and to understand how to administer it, and then they will send it to you and to carry Narcan. It's truly a great service that they provide.
Something about harm reduction. I never even heard about it until you mentioned it.
They are just, yes, and the Dawn Project is another great organization here in Ohio. They do phenomenal stuff with the homeless. We just try to do anything we can because every situation we've come across has been kind of different. Some people will need housing, which most of them do. That's our largest need, I would say, is housing.
Now, that's in Columbus or anywhere you go?
I would say our housing is the largest in anywhere, any city that I've been into. Yeah, it's housing is the largest. Like here, we have people, mothers that are sleeping in their cars right now because they can't. They have, you know, maybe a court record or an eviction or something like that on the record, and so they don't qualify maybe for HUD, or they were on HUD and something has happened to where they got evicted from HUD, so they don't qualify for that service anymore. So
let me ask you, if you go to YouTube, there's, and new videos are added every day, there are many people, some by choice, some not by choice, that are living in their cars, some in vans or whatever. And we're talking about families.
Yes, sir.
Like I say, some by choice, and they've got a system down, and some do it. A lot of the ones that do it by choice, they don't want to pay, you know, what the going rents are and what a particular geographical area that they are. So they're using that lifestyle of living in their car. Some take box trucks and convert them into living areas or whatever, or even school buses. But
yes,
many do live in cars, and a lot of them are single women with no kids. So they do it by choice, so they're able to save, you know, a certain amount of money. And then, of course, there's other people that don't know how to do it. So my question to you is, are some of the ones that are living in their cars, I'm taking for granted most of them, maybe not all of them, might be the working homeless or houseless. And would they be willing to drive 30, 45 minutes or an hour outside of Columbus or wherever they might be to an area where they can get more traditional housing that's sustainable?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. I do think most of them would drive definitely an hour, even 2 hours, I think, if they had to. Mm-hmm. There is a lot that I talk to that seem that they are stuck in a situation. And I don't know if that's because of, you know, like you said, that they feel like maybe they should be there where they're at. Some of them is by choice. Yes, sir. I think some of it is by choice. A lot of it, I think they just don't have a choice. They've run out of maybe options. And there is a lot that would definitely drive an hour to be in a safe, good home, a decent home, or just a lot of them would drive just to be out of the area because of the drugs, gun violence. Mm-hmm.
I know with some of the people I've observed or ran into over the years, many of them, particularly since you're talking about a city the size of Columbus, many of them, the homeless, whether they have a car or any type of transportation or whatever, many of them stay in the city. It could be Columbus, Manhattan, New York, Los Angeles, California, whatever, because of the services that are available to them in Columbus, in this example. It could be social, you know, whatever's office about local social
yes.
services. So if they don't know anything about how to get those needs met once they step outside the boundaries of Columbus, Ohio proper.
Yes, sir. That's yes.
So.
Because we have food pantries every other block here in Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
We have walk-in free clinics right now. Suboxone clinics, for example, food pantries, churches. We have a lot of churches that help. And some people, we do have a page, and it's called Struggling on the West Side. A couple pages. Struggling on the West Side.
Is that on Facebook?
Struggling
or
in Columbus. Yeah, it's on Facebook. Yes, sir.
Okay, Struggling
in
Columbus.
Facebook.
I like that name.
Struggling in Columbus. Yes, sir. Struggling on the West Side, we have that. And we have people that go in there, and it's like a community helpline or a community help page. And I love that page because it's like somebody's like, if I need, you know, $35 for this, for pay my phone, for instance, or my electric, I need $35 on that. We do have organizations that will help them, but there's some people that just need, like, cat food. They'll put posts in there, I'm short on this or that. Can you help me get a bus pass? You know, my cat needs cat food, or I need a sandwich. You just never know, like, every need in there is different. And the lady that runs it, she's really great. She made this page. We actually made this page for, I want to say, I'll say the ladies of the evening. I don't want to, you know, say something rude about them because these are people that
physical
are struggling. You know, and I just want to help them. So we're just out there all the time, but I see these needs and I read the pages. You know, West Side epidemic, all these things. And so when I see that there's ladies, a lot of men too, but a lot of young ladies are out there. We'll say from 15 years old that's been out there until they're 40, basically their whole life. Most of them are mothers and daughters, some of them I've ran into. And the needs are, you just never know what it is. Somebody, sometimes they need a need for like an outfit. They just got a job. Some of them need $20 just for gas, you know, so they can get to their job. So we never know what the need may be or what it is. You know, we just don't know. So that's why this lady created this page. And every day there's just post after post of stuff of what's going on, who needs what, if someone could help with this or that. Housing, there's, like, you know, there's people that's living in their cars, and because they've got kicked off of HUD, they just have really nowhere else to go. And housing is our biggest issue. We have mothers, that's fathers. We have a father with 10 children. They sleep in the van. Half the children are at grandma's, the aunts, down the street, stay at some friend's house. I've tried to help his family a few times, you know, because if they call with a need, I have a hard time telling them no. I do not give them money. Like, I'll meet them at the dollar store. I'll buy juice, cases of juice for the kids or something like that. But I don't like to give them money because with $5, they can actually go out, buy dope, and die on $5. So I really have a hard time giving people money. But we also, through Autumn's Way, just so that people know, we also pay for birth certificates. Sometimes you can get your birth certificate free, but if they are not born here in Ohio, in different cities or states, there's a charge to get a birth certificate, anywhere from $25 to $75 to get birth certificates. And without some places, they can't get into services without that. And so that's why we have a lot of clinics that you don't need ID. You can just walk in. So it kind of depends on the person's need, what they need, if they're willing to get help, or if they're being sent by the court to get help, is sometimes how they receive the help that they get.
Boy, okay.
Yes, sir.
You're in Columbus. You're based out of Columbus. How often do you go to, Oklahoma?
We try to go twice a year, in April, there's like a little gathering meeting with the community in September. It's the second weekend in September every year. It's the powwow. Since COVID, they canceled our powwows, which is how most, and we have people that come in, excuse me, from all over the United States, Texas, Arizona, all Native American. They do the powwow dance. Our tribes give away anywhere from $25,000 to $80,000 for best dance, best dress. They have competitions in dance. They pass out just gift money to help families, the youngest child, oldest children. We help with college grants and stuff if they're Wyandotte. If they're not Wyandotte, they also have grants for college and different things. Very small town, a Wyandotte is right on Route 60. Can't miss the powwow grounds. We're just right there. Right on the freeway. Yes, sir. Powwow grounds is there. And the powwows are so spiritually uplifting. You know, they pray. We have gourd dancers. It's just amazing what they do, the energy from the drum. We call that the grandfather, the heartbeat, and the music. That might be why I'm so connected to music. Music absolutely moves me, moves my soul. I do promote music, some artists here, but, you know, my first passion, of course, is always Autumn's Way Through, helping people, getting them off the street, because we have so many mothers, so many children that have nowhere to go at the end of the day. They can't go in, take a bath, be tucked in bed. And I worry about these people. Sometimes I have sleepless nights. I'm not going to lie, because I do. I worry about, you know, or how can I help them? And if I may, shout out Dustin Sampson, because that's who I network with, 13 different clinics here in Columbus. We network as far as Dayton, Kentucky border, Cincinnati. So there's 13 different clinics, and anyone that wants it, we can get them in. If they want to come to Ohio, the Counseling Center is a great clinic. It's religious, faith-based. They provide medicine. People are not sick. It's just a wonderful, wonderful program. We've had many people complete the program, you know, and thanked us for saving their life, just for letting them know about the program, because they don't know it's free. excuse me, a lot of people think they have to have, you know, insurance, their IDs, and that's why they don't go. So when they run out of excuses and they look at themselves and say, hey, you know, I can do this, I want this, I'm tired of being dope sick, let's go to the clinic. Yes, sir.
Okay, well, you're keeping busy with this, obviously.
We try.
Tell us about, now, sir.
We try to stay busy.
Now, you mentioned your husband, or you and your husband built two small houses?
The Wyandotte tribe. But
oh, the Wyandotte tribe did.
The Wyandotte tribe did, but we are we have the information from elders, from our tribal committee. We can contact them at any time. Truly a phenomenal Wyandotte. They are their family, like I said, family based. And
excuse me one second. So LA, tell her about what we have going on, because I think that this could be one of your people, boots on the ground in your local area.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm picking up what she's saying. Well, essentially,
before we get off the call, okay?
right. I've got a little. I'm physically in Florida right now, but I got some contact Well, I've actually been there and have a vested interest in Muskogee County in Oklahoma.
Yes, sir.
And in one of those, they have satellite towns all through the whole state of Oklahoma, actually all through the United States, as you know. So the idea essentially is we primarily set up shop or buy land first in a rural area, because in rural areas, there are less rules and regulations, and typically we set up shop in a tiny town. There's small towns, like a small town might be, some people might consider a town that's got 25,000 people or even 2,500 people small. But we go to teeny, tiny towns that have populations of probably under 500 people. So in those places, our plan is I've got about 15 acres. I don't want to say 16, but 15 acres. So where we can actually teach people how to build their own house, and they own it outright without a 30-year mortgage, without any institutional financing, without any government programs, none of that stuff. Because if you go back 150 years or so, or 200 years for sure, most people, particularly men, knew how to, you know, build their own homes with the help of relatives or friends in the community. Now, you know, people have mortgages from Wells Fargo, VA loans, FHA loans, Fannie Mae loans, all these loans. And most, I would say a lot of people don't, they don't outlive that loan. And then if you don't pay it back, you know, the bank will take it, and then a family has to start all over from scratch. So I got, you know, some inches out in Oklahoma. Ohio, I took a course there, a retreat, a seven-day retreat, in a little place called Philo, Ohio, P-H-L-I-O. It's maybe about 15, 20 minutes outside of, probably about a good 20 minutes outside of Zanesville, Ohio.
Oh, I know where Zanesville is, yes, sir.
Yeah, Zanesville has got a population of about 25,000, and I would call Zanesville the real United States of America.
Me too, sir.
Right, and then drive 10 minutes drive outside of Zanesville is a completely different world, mostly rural, but those are the places where we buy land. So I haven't done anything. I've interviewed one person on here from Ohio, Chief Baba, or I call him Shango. He was in a documentary film called Flag Wars. It used to be in its entirety on YouTube, but they got some trailers on there still. And it was how people, it was about a neighborhood in Columbus, Ohio that was getting gentrified. In any event, but Columbus is a city of a lot of that has a lot of people in it that, as you well know, I look at it this way, that don't have the skills, the sustainable skill sets to live in Columbus. So
that's
our whole thing
truth.
Here is
yes,
basically,
sir.
Well, if you're willing to drive 30 minutes outside the city, or, and I'm glad you said 2 hours. I'm glad you said 2 hours. Because in some cases, you might have to do that. Because in that 2 hours, you can find, many people can find a sustainable place to live that's affordable, and probably even find employment. And if it's in reach of a Wi-Fi, which most places are these days, then you can work from your home in a place, but, you know, and then if you want to go visit friends that live in Columbus, all right, well, you know, you drive 2 hours to go to church, go to the movies, go bowling, whatever, but it's only a 2-hour drive. So owning their own home, where after they will teach them how to build it, and we teach them about renewable energy, including solar energy, you know, where they don't get any utility bills, no water bills, you know, no electric bill for heat because it gets cold in Ohio. They won't be plugged into any natural gas company, but we'll show them how to, you know, you can. Their alternative way. I know some people, they heat their home with corn, not popcorn, but corn. That's how they do it.
Yes.
Biofuel.
Wow.
And that's a biofuel. So we teach them about that and teach them how, you know, it can be a weekend or and I'm glad you said small homes, because I got a definition for small homes and I got a definition for tiny homes. My definition of tiny homes is like 399 square feet and below. That's a tiny home. And then 400 square feet to, let's say, 900 square feet, I would call a small home. Now, I'm 6'8", all right? So I'm looking at, I don't really need, because I'm extreme now. I'm looking at most people live in a house that's anywhere from 50% to 75% to 80% larger than what they actually need. Because realistically, most people only live in two rooms. I live in one. I got 10 of them, but I live in one.
Mm-hmm.
You don't live in the bathroom. You don't live in the kitchen. So most
That's
people
true.
That have a continuous homeless problem, or this is just L.A. speaking, or a lot of people who are struggling, you know, because some people, they get out of the struggle, or they struggle to get out of the struggle a little bit, and then they find another apartment or a house to live in, and then within 3 months, 6 months, definitely in less within 12 months, they're back where they started a year ago or 3 months ago or 6 months ago, whatever my case might be. It's different for everybody. And they haven't figured out, wait a minute, I'm living in a place and I'm not living in all the rooms. Even if they're married or have kids, they're not occupying. They might have furniture in all those other rooms, but they're not living in all those other rooms. You know, so we get on to educate them on, okay, wait a minute, this is what you need to do to become sustainable. And then, in my opinion, a lot of people need to recognize, you know, because in a city the size of Columbus, there are municipal services that can be expensive to many people.
Yes.
I haven't been to Columbus, so let me use a city I do know. Baltimore, Maryland, matter of fact, I know Detroit too. In both of those cities, there are a lot of boarded up properties. And if you get the backstory on some of those properties, I'll give you one example. There was a young lady, I've been trying to get her on here periodically for the last 5 or 6 years, I haven't had any luck yet. Her house was paid off by her father. He worked hard and paid it off. He passed on, and she was left with the house. Okay, no mortgages on it or nothing. She ended up losing that house because she couldn't pay the municipal water bill. Okay, so a lot of those boarded-up houses in Baltimore, Detroit, and other, though in Columbus, a lot of people cannot afford municipal services. The water bill is too expensive for them. We talk about where I'm at, I'm off the grid with water. I got a well with a reverse osmosis system, and I'm going to put a backup water system on there to harvest rainwater. So in rainwater harvesting is ancient technology. It's been going on for as long as man's been alive. So, but in a lot of cities like Columbus, you're not allowed to probably do a well within the city proper or harvest rainwater. That's another reason why I pick rural locations where you can legally do all this type of stuff, which isn't brand new technology. But most people who grow up in an urban environment don't know anything about wells, rainwater harvesting, how to be sustainable. I mean, with grocery stores, like in Columbus, do they have a Whole Foods in Columbus?
Whole Foods, yes, sir.
Whole Foods grocery store.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Whole Foods.
Mm-hmm. If we go back, and Whole Foods is known for, in air quotes here, organic produce. Okay.
Yes.
Go back 150 years. Well, let's go back to the end of slavery. Okay, 1863. In 1863, whether you were black or white or whatever in the United, what we now call the United States, people, if they wanted organic food, and they didn't call it organic back then, because organic means basically no chemicals, their Whole Foods grocery store was in their backyard. So, you know, we'll be teaching people. I mean, I'm not a farmer or anything like that, a gardener, but we know people that grow their own food. My parents, they had two gardens. So they rarely went to the grocery store for anything. But, I mean, they made ice cream, all sorts of stuff. So a lot of people just really are not cut out. Put it this way, a lot of people that live in Columbus that are homeless or struggling, because there's a whole lot more. If you got, let's say, I'm going to just throw out a wild number. If you got 1,000 people that are homeless in Columbus, and that number might be higher, I don't know, I would say multiply that by 1,000. Well, let's say 500. Multiply that by 500. And that's how many you got struggling in Columbus or Detroit or any other city. And a lot of them are struggling, in my opinion, because they really don't know. All they know is that municipal system of where they're living. Whereas if they drive 30 minutes outside of Columbus or an hour outside of Columbus or 2 hours outside of Columbus, they can find a completely new way of life. You know, so it once I think people become aware of it, then they can make more choices. Are you going to get a whole avalanche of people that will jump on the bandwagon? I don't think so, but I'm an urban guy originally, born and partially raised in Washington, D.C. But D.C., I don't like their municipal, I don't like any municipal city, municipal system in a city that's got a population of over, to be honest about it, over 25,000 people. So for me, I don't buy anything unless it's in the rural area. I don't want any municipal water. I don't want any municipal power. I know how to put this stuff together myself. So anyway, let me get off my rampage rant. But I think some of those people, I don't know what percentage of the people that you talk to, I think if some of those people were exposed to, like Wyandotte, Oklahoma, I think if people were exposed to that, like might live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, if they were exposed to what kind of a lifestyle they can live in Wyandotte, Oklahoma, some of those people would move from Tulsa to Wyandotte or any other satellite cities like that in Oklahoma or Ohio or wherever they might be. Anyway, I'm off my soapbox now. Rant.
Yes.
Okay. So, I can see where we can get a lot of this, even funding. I see some partnerships going on down here in Ohio.
Yeah, they're boots on the ground. They're
okay.
Definitely boots on the ground. Yeah.
Definitely. Because we have a large need. And that's the thing, is we do have people that are just tired of being out on the street. They are, mm-hmm. some people, you know, they're living in hotels, in their cars, because like you
and
just
those,
said,
those,
you know, the
those
water
hotels
field,
are expensive.
Yes, and they're not good. You know, there's, they're
and
just
you
not,
know what, what's interesting about those hotels or motels is there's really an untapped community of people in those hotels and motels, because if they would ever, if you gathered those people that are in those hotels and motels and just talk to people, the skill sets that are needed to build their own village are in that hotel or motel. And I'm just talking about, a little motel that might have maybe 25 units. There's enough people in there where you can probably start your own little village, and you got the, you had the people in there with the skill sets already. They've just never been told, hey, let's get to, let's organize and get together, and let's get a patch of land wherever, and you know, where we can legally do this stuff, and then we can have our own homesteads, or we can have a community garden or what have you. And I think part of this can be learned from some of the Native American tribes, because I like some of these Native American tribes are so organized where everything they need is provided from within the tribe, and there's no need for them to go to a government social services office.
Yes, sir. That's the Wyandots, they are set up like that. We have engineers for building. We have engineers for electrical, plumbing, and, you know, they've learned these skills
right
through the Wyandots. Yes, sir. And like the two new homes that they just built, we went over and did a little tour because they're in our community that they have built. The Wyandots, they're self-built a community. They're now in the process of, we have 700 more acres out there. They're in the process of building other homes. And in the area that it's in, because of the tornadoes and stuff, solar, good for that area because of the tornadoes, high winds. So they're trying to figure out something else, you know, that they could do for solar, you know,
so,
for heat,
so,
for that.
I have a quick question. So with high wind, instead of solar, couldn't they do the turbine?
Yeah. Oh, Robin, yes. Phenomenal. Oh, you're a genius, lady. Yes. Oh, I'm writing all this down, you know. I got my paper. Yes, the turbines. The high winds, you know, because they have every home, at we even in Wyandotte, the population in Wyandotte itself of homes, I think it's maybe like 300 homes or maybe 500. It's not a very big community. I don't want to say it's not even that big. But every home has a storm shelter in the yard. They have community storm shelters. In the school, of course, you know, we have storm shelters there. Tornadoes come up at any time. It's terrible out there. It's been destroyed. Miami, Oklahoma, just so many places out there. I've seen the destruction. And so, you know, the tiny homes, when they built them, okay, they've built them with reconstructive, embrace them, I guess, you know, with more braces, the foundation. And the tiny homes are, they are adorable. They're so cute. They have everything in there. They've already furnished them with pots and pans, blankets, whatever the family may need. And all of this, yes, sir, comes from, like, inside of our tribe. People just come together, the whole community. They are so family-oriented that what one family cannot teach a son or a daughter, we have someone to teach them to hunt, to fish, to build, just someone's always there in the community to help them. But a lot of communities, like you said, they don't have that. They don't have the skills or the resources to actually benefit their community or to father their way of life. They just don't have the resources, materials, or the knowledge to do that. And that may be why a lot of people are still in the same situations, like you said, you know, a little bit ago. They have a home, but yet they can't provide or can't pay the electric or the water bill. And that happens a lot in those groups I was telling you about. There's a lot of people in there asking for help.
Question, Peggy. How old?
Yes, ma'am.
How old are the kids or some of the youth that you're teaching to build?
They are some of them as young as 16 because they've lost their parents, you know, grandparents are gone. So they basically just have some aunts left or something or very few family members. So we're always trying to reach out to the youth groups, help the our children's groups here because they don't have they have less people in their lives. So some of them, Ms. Robin, is, you know, 15, 16, 17, young people, youth. Yes, ma'am. Don't have the skills, you know, because they don't, no one's never taught them. And, you know, I just want to go to Columbus and, like, pick up all the people and, like, where can we take them? Get them off the street. You know, what organization is open right now? Either this shelter closes at 6 or 7. You have to be there at a certain time. So I'm always trying to figure out where we can get them in, where they can go. Food, we have a lot of food pantries. So a lot of churches, we pass out food on the street. We take hot dogs, you know, they just sandwiches, ball of water, pass out Narcan with all that. But they're young, Miss Robin. They're young.
You know what? I want you to listen to this audio as quick as about 2 minutes, and I want your feedback on it. Here we go.
Also tonight, the incredible transformation and the Buffalo Strong spirit that made it all happen. 7 Eyewitness News reporter Taylor Epps shows us how a young lady has completed her very own renovation project.
11-year-old Lauren Nelson had big plans for her summer.
I thought it was going to be pretty fun, but with COVID going on, it was going to be not as fun as it could be.
But things changed one day when she was flipping through an American Girl doll magazine at her home in Attica.
And she showed us a $650 VW bus. My husband was like, that's ridiculous. You could buy your own camper for that price.
So she did just that. Lauren saved some money and started looking. A neighbor just down the road had this 20-foot camper that caught her eye.
And then the one day, up popped a for sale sign, and she squealed the whole way home.
And she started negotiating.
It wasn't very hard. He said $500, and I said $400 because that was the money that I had in my bank account, and he said sold.
Then it was time to renovate.
It was a process. We brought home a family of mice. And so there was a lot of deep cleaning.
But that didn't stop her.
I was very motivated because I really wanted a place where I could just, like, hang out like my own house.
The whole renovation process took Lauren about 2 months. And with the help of family and friends, she was able to turn this into this.
It's called Camp Huguet. It means very comfortable and safe. It has its own kitchen and bathroom, so it's like a tiny house.
So now you're the owner of a tiny home at 11 years old.
Yes.
The whole project cost her $800.
She has 3 envelopes that she puts her money in, give, save, and spend. I think she made a really good choice. She now says she's part of the Tiny Home Nation.
She was able to turn her summer around and hopes to inspire others to do the same.
Which is awesome to see that somebody who's 11 years old had her own vision but now is out there and other people are contacting us and they've gone out and bought a camper to do the same thing. If you're looking to have some big plans in the future, you should go out and do it. Make it happen.
In Attica, Taylor Epps, 7 Eyewitness News.
Well, what do you think? She's 12 years old now. She was 11 when she gave that interview.
Wow. That is amazing. totally phenomenal.
And it sounds like you run into a lot of people that would could do the same thing.
Yes, sir, definitely, definitely. That's our largest need. We have people at the parks, sleeping in the parks, gas stations, abandoned homes in the driveways, just everywhere. There's a lot of people homeless in Columbus, a lot, and they're young people, older people. We just have a lot of homelessness. That is a phenomenal
message. Let me ask you this. You get in your car, you and your husband, and you guys will drive hours and hours and days from one state to you'll put in a lot of effort and a lot of time and a lot of money into helping people. If you had the opportunity to partner with some people and pull our money together and we can invest and buy land and buy material and teach these people how to build houses and start housing people. I want you to think about that, you and your husband. Okay?
Okay, yes, ma'am, yes. Because it's something I'm very interested in. Very interested.
We have some ideas for generating money and income, you know, and with just a few people, even just three people, even just two people, you can set aside money, and then at the end of that money, take that pool of money and invest it, and then keep investing in it, and then we can keep funding our own selves. There's a susu.
Yes.
So just stick around. You need to keep coming back. So that we can.
I'm just so interested. I'm so excited.
One more clip that our regulars have heard a gazillion times, but she hasn't. Let me play this other clip.
Play Nine Friends, too, please. Play the Nine Friends, too, please.
All right, I'm going to play this next clip, which is about 5 minutes, and then right after that I'll play the Nine Friends, and then we'll come back with the open mic.
Thank you.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, And you can do this at an age, at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
All right, now that was Lamar Alexander out in Utah, the state of Utah. And he built that cabin, which he calls a solar cabin. He built that by himself as a solo builder in 2 weeks, 14 days. Peggy mentioned, you know, you got a lot of displaced people or that find their way into these hotels or motels. There's a community there. Now, imagine if you met 10 people in that motel or hotel that had the necessary skills to help you build that cabin, same cabin. Imagine it wouldn't take 2 weeks if you're trying to do it by yourself. So here goes our next audio, which is very brief. I call it Nine Friends.
I'd say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back out the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family going to live in there? Is they going to... I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
Well.
Wow.
LA, if you're talking, we can't hear you. Yeah, so what do you think? Give us your feedback on that, Peggy.
Oh, Miss Robin Lynn, that is truly amazing. We have so many abandoned houses here. Yes, they've got friends. They've got people that know how to do construction, electrical. we definitely have to have more people coming together is amazing. I am blown away just by listening to that. That's all we need is some 9 friends. And I'll pick them up today, and we're going to go build some houses. There's a lot of abandoned houses down here. We need, for property taxes, we could buy up for a little bit of nothing, because some of these places are abandoned because they owe just a little bit of property taxes.
Yeah.
Wow. That is amazing, and that's doable. That is projects that are very doable. There's people right now that I know, and they all know each other, that's living in this hotel. I mean, this is so crazy that I'm hearing this today, because I know people that are living in hotels. They get up, go to work. The mother or father stays home with the kids, or in the room, and they just live at the hotel. So we just need a little bit of property here and there. Oh, so many ideas right now are, I'm writing a lot of stuff down. I've wrote so much down from the, so much great information right here. The tiny homes could help thousands of people. And he was talking about 500, but he was right when he said it the first time, 1,000, because we actually have thousands of people that are homeless in Columbus. So he hit the nail right
and
on.
And those people, what we say around here is they have to build to live. So watch this. The Salvation Army, for example, you go there and they give you the first 3 days free. Then you have to pay so much. Then you have to, you're required to go out and get a job, right?
Yes, ma'am.
So
yes, ma'am, that's
how
it works.
So here you'll come, you'll have a place to stay, and you won't get up and go out to work, but you will get up and work and start building your house. And
can you guys hear me now?
Yes, we can. And they've been
I had to call back in
a day or even overnight, as you just saw. So,
well, I've done volunteer work. It's a project, it's global now, by the United States Department of Commerce, called the Solar Decathlon. They do it about once every 2 years. And I did volunteer work with that three events, 2007, 2009, 2011. And the Solar Decathlon was basically a college competition. It was about 19 to 21 homes, universities, mostly in the United States, but they did have a university from Germany, China, France, and Spain. Depends on the year. It's different every 2 years. And they would come to Washington, D.C. on the mall, the National Mall, and they would erect from scratch a solar village composed of 19 to 21 homes, depending on how many universities will participate that particular year. And it would be a competition. And the houses would have to, they had 10 points, but the house would have to run like a regular, normal house, cooking, cleaning, toilets, washing clothes, all using solar energy. And the exciting part, going back to 9 Friends part, the most exciting part about that competition is, you know, they would start 1 minute after midnight, and you would actually see an entire village, infrastructure and all, go up within 12 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That same thing could be done anywhere.
Yes.
Wow.
And so I was telling her about the build to live. They come.
Right.
They arrive. They've got a place to stay. They get up, and they build their place living. Mm-hmm. And then we also are teaching them to, as well, to create a business as well.
Yeah, a community-based business. Yeah, it can do that.
A community-based business. Oh, yeah. So go ahead, L.A. I'm listening.
Well, Peggy, I'm just because she's out there on the, you know, boots on the ground.
Right, but you. So why don't you reel her on in by giving her some more?
Well, we got a Patreon group that we're starting up this week, so she's invited to join that, and then because we can get into more specifics on particular geographical areas. I mean, she's physically in the Columbus, Ohio area, so. I can see, what we can do on that end. And, because one of the reasons why I like the Laura Nelson, audio, she was just 11 years old. And with with the help, put it this way, if a kid, if I learn how to build or renovate a camper or build my own little cabin, teen years. Imagine what that does to a person's self-esteem. A teenager's self-esteem. I mean, it happens in the Amish community and the Mennonite community to a high degree too.
We everywhere. There used to be rites of passage. Girls were married by 13, boys 15. They were taught how to build houses. They were homeowners in school. They taught home economics, shop, things that when we graduated, you could take in. We don't even have Lincoln Logs anymore.
Yeah, I remember those. Yeah.
we're doomed. We're doomed. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so, because there's
no.
And you know what? The thing is, we're talking about if you build something small or tiny, you don't have to stay there. There's been examples of people, and they're on YouTube, where there was a lady that I ran across about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, divorced lady, had 4 kids. One was an infant. The kid wasn't walking yet. But her and the 3 children that she had that could work got on YouTube, and they built, a 2,000-square-foot home. You can learn some of the fundamentals, doing this stuff. And I think with this pandemic, when the moratorium gets fully lifted, and it is in some places already, family can get together and build, and they'll have a debt-free house. And, they'll know where to build and all the legalities of it, and as we brought up yesterday, that there's stick building, and then there are other innovative ways that people extreme. I call it extreme housing, cabins, foldable houses, tiny houses. Stuff that you might not be legally allowed to build in a place like Columbus, but maybe a short distance away you can. But for some people that might want to come into Columbus and build, based on whatever the local zoning laws are there, learn the fundamentals in one place and then adjust them, apply those fundamentals to some. If you want to live in a large city like Columbus, Cincinnati, Cleveland, San Francisco, L.A., Boston, all those other places. So, we like to work with you on that. And
I'm very, very interested in everything else that you have to say about this. You know, because we were even talking about the shipping containers, using them for homes. Because I was telling my husband, you know, we've got so many people, we've got to do something about the housing because we are running into roadblocks, you know, with evictions or felonies, small felonies, not, you know, nothing really bad, but
well,
just
you know, if
be
you're
some
a felon,
type of need a second chance.
Yeah, if you're a felon, there's no law that says you can't learn how to build your there's no law in the books that if you're a felon, that you can't do what 11-year-old Lauren Nelson did. You are free to learn how to build. You are free to actually build it. Felony conviction or not.
I'm going to be one of those 9 friends because I got hammer nails. I've got some little bit of extra wood laying around right now. I'm interested so much in this. So exciting.
And let me play one last clip I think you'll like. It's the Tiny House Family. Then we'll go to some other calls.
Imagine living in a space that measures a mere 168 square feet, more than 14 times smaller than the average American home. Well, it is here inside this tiny house where the proud owners are discovering that less is so much more.
Well, in the past year, we've managed to save everything that I earn. We use my husband's income for our living expenses, and I've been teaching public school, so that's about $3,000 a month that we've put in the bank this year.
Hari, her husband Carl, and their 2 young kids, Archer and Ella, recently celebrated their 1-year anniversary in their tiny house. After losing their 1,500-square-foot home to financial struggles, the couple took matters into their own hands, literally. They built this space themselves with just $13,000 in materials. Their goal? To become debt-free and save enough to one day build a new home, mortgage-free. And so far, they're right on track.
Things are going really well with the next project. We're going to build a 16-by-24 unit to begin with, and then we'll branch off of that and add bedrooms.
You may remember seeing this family on The Anderson Show earlier this year, where I joined them on stage. Fascinated by their story, our financially fit team flew down to Virginia to see for ourselves and learn ways we can all downsize.
How are you?
Hey,
really good.
You. Hey there.
Living in the tiny house has taught me that we don't need much at all to be happy, and that getting the things that we need can actually be a lot of fun.
Can you get me a bowl and some scissors?
The family's fruit and vegetable garden lets them eat healthier, cut down on their carbon footprint, and slash their grocery bill by as much as 30%. Hari has also been upcycling, as she calls it, taking something old and breathing new life into it.
My favorite upcycling project was the rugs I made for the house. I took old sheets, flat sheets, and crocheted them into rugs. They're beautiful, and they fit the house a lot nicer than if we had gone and bought something new from the store.
The couple also recently switched jobs, not for more money, but more happiness. Carl is enjoying better working conditions at a new restaurant, and Hari left teaching to pursue a career in nonprofit. Being able to afford a career that you love and pursuing a passion rather than a paycheck, they've learned, is just an added benefit to having savings and no debt.
I'm probably taking a 25 to 30% cut in my salary, which is going to enable me to have more time to actually build the house and save money because I'll be the contractor.
It's really a great feeling to be able to make a decision like that, not based on money, but based on what we want to be doing with our time.
The kids also seem keen to the transition. Mom and Dad are happy to report fewer requests for video games or toys now that Ella and Archer are busy playing outdoors on their 3-acre property.
We play down by the creek and up at the big tree up there where the swing is. We play with our neighbors and ride bikes.
There's a lot of different things they can do with their time besides
play with plastic toys and get online.
They've really just embraced it wholeheartedly. You can't stop them from having a good time outside.
Still another lesson, when you downsize, it helps to have a support system.
There's such a wealth of knowledge in our community, and that helps us a lot. And having that support makes it like we're doing it together. Moving to the country has given us a lot of things, not just the tiny house.
So, what do you think? What are your thoughts about living in a tiny house? Would you ever do it? Connect with me on Twitter at Farnoosh and use the hashtag FinFit for Yahoo Finance. I'm Farnoosh Tarabi.
Hello, yes, that's amazing.
All right, L.A., I don't know what happened to L.A. So any, what are your thoughts? Any thoughts or input on that, what we listened to?
Wow. That is, wow, just amazing. Everything, so much knowledge. Wow, that's some stuff to take in. You know, people just need to be, I think, a little bit more educated. This is empowering. You know, this whole episode of the tiny home, everything. This is so much knowledge and goodness. This could help.
Can you hear me now?
Thousands.
Yes, there you are.
All right, boy. All right, glad, Peggy, you're getting ideas out.
LA, I need to let you know I might have to jump off the line for a conference call, but Peggy will
right,
stay
no
on with you if I do.
All right, no problem. All right, well, let's all right, we got a caller here, 314. I'm going to open your mic. 314, your mic is open.
Ellie, what's going on?
Well, everything's good here, but I got a call after this show to New Orleans. I don't want to make that call, but I may have
to
get it over with.
Oh, I know what that's about. Your house, the roof don't fill in.
I hope that ain't the case. But anyway, it's something that's going to cost money. That's all I know.
Yeah, I know, man. But I hear what you guys are talking about. How are you going to pay for all this?
That's where we'll do it on Patreon. Well, not using Patreon, but as a fundraising tool. But you know, getting ideas from people. I mean, that's what I've been doing. You know, you get ideas from people, you brainstorm, and you come up with ways on how to get things paid for.
Now, where are these homeless people at now? In the city?
Well, where Ms. Osborne is calling from right now, she's talking about, you know, I think she talked about Columbus, Ohio, and then some experiences.
That's a major city, right?
Yeah, that's a major
city.
Yes,
sir. Mm-hmm.
Now, let me ask you a question. You going to move these people out to the rural area and build them a tiny house? What are they going to do, sit on the front porch the rest of their life? They don't have no transportation, don't have no jobs. No skills. You guys
well,
think
I can
of
answer
that,
that
far ahead?
In part.
Huh?
Yeah.
We also teach them
how to build a house. We also teach them about building and creating a business as well.
You got to factor this in also. Some of those people have transportation. Okay.
And something else that we also don't discuss is security.
Yeah.
Well, something else you ain't discussing either is liability. Suppose they get hurt building these houses, who's going to be liable?
Well, once again, as I said,
I'm just asking these questions.
We're not the people directly involved.
But
with the people that you get involved. No, when you get people involved, okay, they're going to come up with the ideas on transportation. Like I said, out of that group, you're going to have one or two people that have reliable transportation. All right.
Yeah, they got to have transportation.
Somebody out of that group,
insurance.
Might start a business out of that.
Yeah.
Place that you get in a rural area might have Wi-Fi. So you're going to have some people that might want to work remotely. It's not going to be the same thing for everybody, but my whole philosophy of life is this. Every problem has multiple solutions. How
well, you're dealing with a lot of people, you're going to have
I don't know.
Yeah, if you're dealing with a lot of people, you're going to have multiple problems. There ain't going to be no one problem with multiple
people. I'm saying is you deal with small groups. You deal with small groups, and it works its way out.
Yeah. All right, well, I just wanted to put some things out there so that you know what to expect.
Yeah, you work with small groups. You see what you're working with. Because this, once again, this isn't for everybody, okay? Some people, they just want to stay in Columbus, okay? That's fine, and whatever way it works out for them, it works out for, you know, them. But, you know, as far as transportation, a lot of these problems can be resolved within a small, and basically I think it's the best results happen when you're dealing with a small group of people. It's a small group.
How many homeless do you have in Columbus, ma'am? Hundreds? A thousand? A dozen?
Peggy? Messing with the mute button. I'm so sorry.
In
Wyandotte, we have two small homes. And
no, how many homeless do you
in
have?
Here in Ohio, we literally have over 3,000 people that are homeless. Just on one side of our town, Columbus, we do have a lot of homeless. We have homeless coalitions. We have homeless shelters, and they're all full. There's a waiting list for our homeless shelters. So emergency shelters, people that's taken their homes, and it's just like turned in a bedroom to bringing people home or from the shelter that's overloaded. There's a lot of people that signed up with the shelters to bring mothers, families, homes that they stay there for a couple of days till they're transitioned with like social services that will help them into a place. Some of them get to stay a long time. Some of them don't qualify for some of the programs, so they end up homeless again.
Do they have children?
Yes, sir. Yes. Most
school,
of them do
school
have
age
children.
Children?
Yes, sir. Yes. And a lot of them live in their vans. They go to the gas stations, wash their clothes out in the sinks, stay at the parks. Go to the church to eat. They try to make it back to the shelter by 6 o'clock. But if it's closed by 6, then they're homeless on the street in their car. The shelters are full. And, again, we have 3,000 people or more a night that don't have any place to lay their head. We do have a lot of properties that are abandoned, some that are just for taxes. You could buy for taxes. We have a lot of people with a lot of skills, construction workers that are out of jobs, due to the pandemic. A lot of places are just not building like they was before the pandemic. The tiny homes, we have tent cities that are under the bridges, and I go out sometimes with some of the churches, and we fix up meals that we take out, at least once a week. We have churches that go out every day for the homeless because they have nowhere to go. Again, air shelters are full, so we have nowhere to get them off
the
street.
Well, what I was getting at, and I can't tell you about the houses in the city, But I just wanted to point out some things you have to take in consideration if you're going to be building outside of the city in a rural area. And it would be basically just like you have a house anywhere. You got to have people to build it. They got to be covered in case of liability. You have to have insurance on the property when it's done. You're going to have a way to get them kids to school. And those children are going to have to be inoculated and all those sorts of things. So it's not just as easy as it sounds. And plus, they're going to have automobile transportation. They're going to have insurance for the automobile because the parents are going to have to be able to get to school in case something goes on with the kids. So all those things have to be taken into consideration. And to say that we're going to do this for the homeless is easy to say, but when you start laying that out on the paper, you got a whole lot of problems there that has to be addressed. And I'm just throwing ideas out there and sharing the information so you know what to expect.
That's true.
When
is this
project supposed to get?
If you keep, a group small, I mean real small, a lot of those problems can be figured out within the people directly involved within the group. Because let's say out of 3,000 people, now here's my thing. Out of 3,000 people, my whole thing is everything's just, you know what, help one. Just start with one. Because out of the 3,000, number one, you're not going to save, you can't save everybody. Okay, that's not going to happen.
True.
And it, for most people, it's not going to be for everybody. I would say easily out of that 3,000, 50 to 70%, if not 80%, if it's not inside Columbus proper or Los Angeles City proper or New York City proper, they don't want to have anything to do with it, no matter what you say, no matter what videos you play.
Well, that leaves you with 600. At least you with 600 people, you got to make this work for it.
I'm saying start with one. Start
all
with
right.
one and work from there.
Now, when you guys going to start this? We can keep track a running diary.
Robin just dropped off the line with that. What we'll do is we'll have another powwow with offline with Miss Osborne and Robin and whoever else.
Yeah,
it
may be a model that some other you can be used.
Yeah,
elsewhere.
And like I say, start with one. Just start with one. Document it, and go from there.
All right, there you go. Well, we'll keep
but
an eye on
you. If
you
look at 3,000, this is a hypothetical. If you got 3,000 people. And you, 10% of that is, 300, 10% of that, 10% of that, 1% is 30. No. That's too many people. Start with one. Then work your way up to two. Then work your way up with three. But let concentrate with one. And a lot of things that you just said, and some things that you didn't say, or haven't come out during this podcast, you know, are going to have to be resolved. That's why everything needs to be documented. You got to stair step it. That's the way I look at it anyway.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to monitor. Well, I'm going to continue to listen.
All right. Anyway, Peggy, Robin.
Yes, sir.
All right, she might be back because she took that conference call. Anyway, so now do you and your husband, you go out, every day, weekly, monthly, or what?
I go down into Columbus. Because I'm an hour. We just moved. We bought a house an hour from Columbus. But I do go out. I try to at least go three times a week, but I always go twice a week taking out street bags to Columbus. That's peanut butter, jelly sandwich, bottle of water, information of where they can go and get help for the night, get off the street, clinics, free clinics, you know, for medical purposes. All for our coalition on housing, which is the shelters. And, again, most of them were full. But I always go out at least twice a week to deliver those street bags.
just so we can try, you know, more, get people more information to get them off the street. Give
okay.
them, yes, sir.
Now, let me ask you this. Now, I don't know how involved you get with these people. Are some of them, because some people, all right, some people are the working homeless, okay? They have
yes.
a job. They have a 9-to-5. It's a steady 9-to-5. They have working and reliable transportation. That's one segment. But you also have, because there's so many different fragments or niches within the homeless population, you also have
yes.
the substance abusers, and then you also have the mentally ill. So what do you mostly run into when you're out there?
That is a very deep, good question because of there is so much mental illness within the homeless, and then they use drugs, and that, of course, causes a lot of other problems within.
Yeah, that exacerbates it. Yeah, you're right.
Yes, sir, it does. The most problem I think I run into, I would say, would be the drug use right now. Drugs have changed, you know, their brain, how they, you know, just receive anything. Some of them with mental issues, they're scared of, like, our police departments. They're scared of officials in any way. So when we go out to them in the homeless camps, you know, to take them food or whatever, some of them are scared of us. You know, we have a lady that goes with us, and, you know, she always tells them, I'm from the church. You know, we wear ID badges of who we are, from the church, and we're just here to bring you some food, blankets. There's a lot of people that's struggling, I mean, on a daily, and they don't, people don't realize how fortunate we are that we do have a home, because these people's goal is to get off the street. A lot of them have very limited on friends or family, and their mental issues or their drug use have pushed them farther into the homeless village, I should say, you know.
Yeah, because what I'm thinking about, particularly in the liability aspect of it is, is how do you determine which ones that you can actually help? Because a person with some type of mental illness, and I'm no expert on nothing with that at all, but, you know, they might verbally say, oh, yeah, I want to learn how to build a tiny house. But start working with them, you got all kind of issues popping up. Or you might have another one that when you meet them, they might be perfect. They might seem perfectly whatever normal looks like to somebody, but they could be a meth addict. Now, the closest I've been to somebody, because I get a lot of day labor, but I get them maybe from a Salvation Army or a men's shelter or something like that. And typically, the ones that might have a drug habit, they might work for a day and get their $80 for that day or $50 for that day, and you might not see them again. Other people might be good workers and they don't have any mental issues or anything like that. Then other people, I remember one time I had some day labor paint a house for me, and they did great work, paid them no problem during work hours. 2 o'clock in the morning, I hear the doorbell ring. It's one of them that was on the crew. So I'm thinking, all right, this dude's up here looking for drugs. I mean, 2 o'clock in the morning. Comes back to the location.
Yeah.
So I'm asking all that to ask, any way that you can, I guess, vet who you could help, unless you had to employ or partner up with a social worker, and even social workers can only do so much.
Yes. We Absolutely. Meet with the people. We're out there with them. Most people we do see on a daily basis or, you know, every week.
All right.
So they are like
all right, so you've got some type of relationship with them. You know them a little
yes,
bit.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. We try to, you know, there's some people that, you know, are new to the street. Like I said, we do have a lot of young people out here for one reason or another. Their parents are either locked up in jail or dead. So we do have a lot of younger people that we're seeing. But we do have a lot of middle-aged like 30 to 50 age group, and there's a lot of those. And so when we speak with them, you know, we watch like their body language. We ask them questions. You know, how did they end up here? What caused them to be out here on the street to begin with? And we talk with them and what is there to get off the street? You know, what do they have any skills? We ask them because, you know, there's people like day laborers that will come by that we network with that we could put this person here for one day or, you know, this week if they're working, doing this type work. But we talk with them and we see what services that we can, if they're mental, if they're like, you know, any of that going
on. You know what
so
I
we
think?
We have like
the
help
nurse
skill. And kind of.
I think the number one skill that's needed, and I don't know what they do at the social services office, I think the number one, and I consider it a skill, that a lot of the homeless need, maybe not all of them, but many of them, is the social skills needed to make friends and maintain healthy relationships. And here's why I'm saying it's because a lot of people, and I'm looking at, matter of fact, I'm going to give the origins of It's My House. This show got started basically because of a squatter that I had announced. Now, I had known this person and had a decent business relationship with this person for about 3-4 years. Then they moved to New York City, and then about 2 or 3 years later, they moved back down to the area. And they got kicked out of their sister's and brother-in-law's house. They were on their way to a shelter. Now, I should have saw that as a red flag there. And this is why I say social. This was a woman that she called the police on her brother-in-law in his house, who's married to one of her sisters. So I don't know the backstory on that, but she burnt the bridges at the house that where she was staying at. She was on her way to a shelter, and she had a mother. Her mother had a place. Her father had his own place. She had an uncle that I knew about. He had his own place. And she had another sister. So if you've got 5 blood relatives, and none of them will take you and your daughter in. And her daughter was like maybe 8, 9, 10 years old, somewhere in that range. And you're headed to a shelter. I didn't notice at the time because if I had processed this, I wouldn't have let her in the house. Of course, and there wouldn't have been no It's My House. Had I processed that, this person is socially bankrupt. She has burnt the bridges. Now, I let her in my place as a house sitter. I said, you don't have to pay me any rent. You know, you just pay the utility bills and the cable bill when it comes in because you're using those, but you don't have to pay me a penny's worth of rent. That worked out great for 2 years until I told her you have to move. And 2 years is enough time where she could have saved her money and moving to buy a house or whatever. But I'm looking at this. These are 6 people, including me, the 6th one, where she used up all of her social capital and she's socially bankrupt. She has no blood relatives, obviously no other friends that she can even go and say, can I sleep on your couch? Can I sleep in your garage? I think the number one skill, and I call it a skill, is learning how to get along with others. and maintaining those relationships, because you never know when you might need to sleep on somebody's couch. That's my take on the number one skill for the homeless. I don't know how that's going to work out for the people that might have a mental illness issue. But I think that's the number one skill. And I don't know, you might know better than me, are they teaching people how to get along with people at the social services office?
Yes, sir. We do have programs that teaches people, you know, acceptable behavior and unacceptable behavior.
Okay.
And those programs, you know, it's because I deal a lot with, you know, the addicts and the addiction mm-hmm. side, and these people's brains are completely, twisted and turned by the drug. You know, the brain, the connectors in the brain are not connecting like they should. So they mm-hmm. do and say things they should not do or say, or they steal. That's why a lot of people out here, you know, they are not allowed back at their parents' or grandparents' house or their brothers' or sisters', is because right. they've stolen stuff, they're not trusted, you know, and these are people that are broken and they need life skills. Some of them are, you know, out of prison. They do mm-hmm. have skills. We have people that have skills, but they can't find a job.
Right.
So, you know, the mental side and the drug side, we really have to, you know, talk with the person, ask them questions, watch their body language, see what they say, how they respond to questions, you know, and we do have people that take people out for jobs and for work, and we network with them. How did they do? You know, we've had some people that go to these people to work, and they've worked like an hour, left the job site. They've never come back. We'll see them back on the street. And we don't know if they're just so broken. We don't know if it's the drug, but we will continue to help them. You know, if they reach out, we continue. We stop by, check on them. Is there anything we can do to offer them, to get them into a clinical rehab, into a mental facility? Is there a family member that we can call to actually get them the services that they need? Because mm-hmm. some people are scared to ask for services, and some people don't know where to go to get the
right.
service that they need. You know, so the insurance and that type stuff, we have services that will get that for them on the spot. You know, they don't need
okay.
to go to Social Security sign up, or, you know, to get an ID to the DMV. They can do that for them on the iPad, and we can have that mailed to a certain address, people that don't have an address. So there's, you know, ways that they can get their IDs and stuff to them without, per se, having a post office box. That helps them
okay.
so we can get them a post office box and get them into networking and get them where they need to be. But it is hard, sir, yes, to decipher if it's mental, if it's drugs, and it is a lot of, you can be helped. Some people don't want help. They can never be helped. They're going to stay in the same situation because they don't want to excel to the next level of life or
right.
to get out of the situation. You know, so
mm-hmm.
that's where they need other services. And then there's some people, it's like, please, if I just had a job, I just need a place to live to get my children. So those
mm-hmm.
are the people that we are really trying to impact with, you know, the small homes, the tiny homes, trying to get them housing because of our, you know, our shelters are overrun. They're just too full. There's waiting lists for months.
Mm-hmm.
They're waiting to get into a homeless shelter, which is unacceptable to me because, I don't know, you know, our city is so large, and I know we do a lot of services, but I'm just always thinking there's a little bit more, maybe something else that needs to be done, because there is people that really want to work. They just are not given that opportunity, or they don't have that little break to sometimes they just need a little break to excel. That's what we try to help with.
Okay, well, you've got a lot of compassion and experience and whatnot, so we'll see what we can come up with on that note. Thank you, Ms. Osborne, and Robin is on another call right now, but we're going to wrap it up for today. We'll probably get back with you, I guess, sometime this afternoon or today, and so we can get rolling on it, because I really like what you and your husband are doing. So thank you for calling in. Let me mention this before we go. Okay, today's podcast is titled Chinese Food Cash Flow versus 9-to-5 Paychecks. Okay, let me throw this in. We're going to roll this into tomorrow, but let me roll it in, do a quick abbreviation on this, and I think we can tie it into here it is. This can help people who are struggling or might be homeless. Okay. Let's start with, once again, Chinese food cash flow versus 9-to-5 paychecks. Now, typically a person who has a 9-to-5, they work 40 hours a week, they're going to get two paychecks a month. Some people get paid every week, all right? If you do day labor, you get paid, you know, if you do it Monday through Friday, you get 20 paychecks, you know, on a monthly basis, all right? Globally, some people get paid like once every 30 days, all right? Even in this country, some people get paid once every 30 days. But typically, the typical person that has a 9-to-5, they get two paychecks a month, all right? So as I mentioned yesterday, and when you get a chance, pick yourself up a menu. It could be a menu for any type of restaurant. The menu that I'm looking at right now is a Chinese restaurant menu, all right? And I'm just briefly just going over this. We'll go into more details tomorrow. There are over 211 items on this menu. Okay, that's over 211 opportunities to get paid. All right, the least expensive item menu is 75 cents. That's for some crispy noodles. All right, the most expensive item, and they have a few of them on here, is $10.95. All right, the average customers that come through a restaurant doors is around about 330, but I'm gonna narrow it down to about 200. All right, 200 customers a day, and they've got over 200 items to pick from. That's, once again, that's 211 possible paychecks. I mean, not possible paychecks, you know, because you know everybody doesn't want, is not going to order 200 items. Now, on average. Now, this is just a Chinese food carryout. They take in, on average now, some take in more, some take in less, is $111,860.70. That's the monthly gross revenue from a Chinese food carryout here in the United States. That's over $1.2 million a year. So I'm putting that out there because for those of you who might be struggling, for those of you who might be homeless, and matter of fact, I've got to up my product line because I got this phone call in about 30 minutes. I got to make New Orleans. I already know how much it's going to cost. I don't know how much it's going to cost, but I know it's going to cost me something. So I'm looking at, you know what, take a look at a Chinese food menu. See how many items that you can come up with that you can sell on a regular basis. Don't try to get all 200 at one time or even 100. Start off with one item, and then you might even come up with eventually 30 items. That means if 10 items are not selling well that month, you still got 20 paychecks coming in where you won't be struggling. So we'll go more into details tomorrow on Chinese cash flow versus 9-to-5 paychecks. Once again, Peggy, thank you for calling in. Everyone have a good rest of the day.